to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Plant Life and Virtual Life, you'll take a tour through the specialty crop greenhouses Alberta Agriculture runs just north of Edmonton. That's where Dr. Mohyeddin Mirza looks after research into medicinal plants and biological controls, which will benefit Alberta's greenhouse growers. From there, you'll be transported into the virtual lab of Dr. Michael Ellison. Here, where he is surrounded by a bank of computers and mass spectrometers, this biochemist will create virtual life. And the model for Project CyberCell is E. coli. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. A trip to the Crop Diversification Research Center takes you right into the heart of Market Garden Country just north of Edmonton. On the day of my visit, a crisp of ice covers the ground, but the sun shining in a clear blue sky signals it won't be lingering long. As we walk down the path to a row of greenhouses, Dr. Mohyeddin Mirza explains that it's this blessing of sunlight that makes the greenhouse industry viable in Alberta. Year-round, producers grow cucumbers, tomatoes, lettuce, and peppers, as well as cut flowers, bedding plants, and tree seedlings for sale into the local market. It's here that Dr. Mirza is experimenting with a variety of new plants, growing mediums, and pest controls to help expand the greenhouse market. Our first stop is the greenhouse where he's researching a medicinal plant from the Far East.
In this greenhouse, what a typical visitor will look at is a plant called Gotu Kola. I'll spell it for our audience because a very interesting plant, G-O-T-U-K-O-L-A, that's the common name, and the botanical name is Hydrocotyle asiaticum. This is a plant originally came from India or Sri Lankan area, but this has a potential which is used as a medicinal purposes as a nerve tonic and also for memory. There's a lot of product on the market which are made from this plant. And as you could see here, the plant is easy to grow, is the leaf which we are harvest. In this greenhouse, we are growing them in a peat moss medium, and also we are trying a different hydroponic method. We are growing them straight in water and nutrients. So the demand is developing. We are in contact with some people who are willing to buy this material and buy more locally. The quality of this material, when we got it tested from a lab, it came out extremely good, actually. They were so happy to see.
When I first saw it, I thought you had some wonderful geranium seedlings coming up, but it looks like these are doing very well and they form a mat. Could you tell me a little bit more about the plant and the actual research that you're doing, what sort of comparisons you're making?
At this time, we are looking at two growing media. One is straight soilless media, which is a peat moss, and also we are looking at coconut fiber. It's called coir, and we are devoting some benches to that, and then we are also studying the effect of nitrogen on them. It's mostly a leafy plant. You're right, leaf looks like geranium, but it has a different taste than geranium. If you eat it, it gives you slightly bitter taste in your mouth, but the way the plant grows is interesting. It's like a creeper, it's like a mint, and also it hangs down pretty nicely. You see on the side of the benches. So we are going to build a different system as well to grow so that we could have higher production. In addition, on your right-hand side, that bench you will see the plants are being grown in a hydroponic system. So there is a floating system where there's only water and nutrients, and the plants are growing at the top. And you could see that bench is also giving us very good plants.
Now, looking at the research that you're doing here, do you have any preliminary results as to which might be the best way to go?
We are finding both methods are very good, the hydroponic one and also in a peat-based media. The advantage of peat-based media is that you could grow an organic fertilizer experiment. In a purely hydroponics, the fertilizer part, you have to still use some inorganic fertilizer, so that may not be a certified organic area, but that we are exploring that further as well. So both media are pretty satisfactory. One thing I like about this plant is that is not that much susceptible to insects and diseases. We have grown this crop for almost 3-4 years without any insects on them. I don't know whether they don't like it, or the leaf texture is such, or it has some chemical ingredient there, and it could be harvested up to 4-5 times a year, and so you don't have to finish the crop, you could keep on harvesting it.
Now, once this plant is grown, how would it actually be produced to make the medicinal? Would you just take the leaves and throw them in a salad, or do they have to be dried and crushed up and then the active ingredient removed?
There are many ways. An average consumer could eat 2, 3, 4 leaves as a salad. That's commonly done. But our idea is to do some commercial experimentation. The leaves will be dried and powdered and made into capsules, and also could be made into tinctures as well. There is a grower in Alberta, in Moranville Greenhouses. They're already experimenting with making tinctures.
Well, let's go have a look at the vegetable greenhouse.
Yeah, sure. We'll go to vegetables now.
Leaving behind the tables of Gaudicola, we walk across the pea gravel floor to the door. Greenhouse crops bring in revenues of $95 million a year in Alberta. And part of that success is based on the sale of seedless cucumbers. But cucumbers are susceptible to fungus that attacks the roots of hydroponic plants. A flush of warmth and humidity welcomes us into the next building, where Dr. Mertz is conducting a collaborative study on cucumbers with the Alberta Research Council.
In this greenhouse, what you notice here is these are seedless cucumber being grown. And the reason you see many plants are dying here, that's where we inoculated this fungus called Pythium, which normally attacked the root and destroyed the root hair. So as a result, that plant cannot grow properly. This is a big problem with many of the cucumber growers, which are growing in hydroponic system, and also sawdust culture, which is more commonly used. So this is a bacteria which is they isolated originally from some source, and we are finding that if bacteria is present, then it could protect the roots from infection from that fungus. So what you see in this greenhouse will be some very healthy plant. That's where either bacteria is there or different combination treatments are there. So it seemed like that this bacteria is working. It could coat the root zones, and then the fungus cannot attack it. Some of the dead plant which you see here is where the fungus is present. And that's what you find, those plants are dead.
What's innovative about this?
We call it biological control. So this means if this bacteria could be brought to a commercial stage, this means that there won't be any pesticide used and it's very environmentally friendly. That's a naturally occurring enemy of the fungus. So we already have biological control for insects quite a bit. So this is in the root zone are very complicated. So we are hoping that this bacteria could be after testing, we want to bring it to a stage where it could be commercialized and could be used by the growers. So less stress on the environment, less use of pesticide, that's what we're looking for.
In the testing that you're doing, what things are you finding out?
Up to this time, before the experiment come to this stage where we're testing about 200 plants, we have already tested in the laboratory scale, and we found that if the bacteria is present in the root zone before the fungus attacks, the fungus cannot multiply properly. And finally, it dies off. So right now, at this stage, our preliminary results indicate that on a semi-commercial scale as well, the bacteria is maintaining its advantage of destroying that fungus. So this is what's coming out of this experiment up till now. We still want to repeat it 2, 3 more times from this totally recycling system. Right at this time, there's no growing media. Plant roots are growing straight in water. So next time we want to put a crop with actually sawdust as a growing media and then see if the logistic changes.
In order for the greenhouse industry to expand, producers need new varieties of crops to offer consumers. And so a greenhouse provides the perfect environment to experiment with exotic species, such as the vertical growing squashes at our next stop.
In this greenhouse we are growing 4 varieties of squash which originally came from Israel, and these are the first time we saw some varieties which have a vertical growing habit. What normal habit is that the plant is more horizontal, but in this it's like cucumber, it will keep on growing. These are greenhouse varieties, and you've already noticed that how good they're flowering. So a lot of squash fruit is already coming out. So what we are going to learn here, how these varieties perform, and we also want to learn how to manage the crop. Should we remove the flower or not? How many should be allowed to develop? That's the kind of research which is going on. And also that the crop is being grown on a rock wool here. Rock wool is also another inert growing media which we are evaluating for our purpose.
What's it made out of?
Rockwool is basically a natural calcium carbonate rock which is spun into a fiber and then make into these blocks. Very inert material, is free of diseases, so is very suitable for greenhouse culture.
Do you know beforehand any of the differences between the varieties?
Not really. Until we evaluate them, they looks like some of them have different growth habits. So that's what we want to evaluate. And then we want to know what sort of total production we could get per square meter, per square foot. And that's the information, plus the agronomic information, that how big the leaf is going to be, what type of insects going to come, any diseases, disease potential is there. That's the kind of information we will get from here. What you notice here is they're all on a drip irrigation system. So our listeners could visualize that, right, there are two rows of plants. In between the rows, there's a 3/8-inch pipe, PVC pipe, and then there are drip lines. So on a exact timer, the plants are given food whenever they need it. So 6-7 times a day, they will get the water with nutrient solution. Also, you notice on the right-hand side, there is a carbon dioxide generator there. Carbon is one of the main compound which the plant need to grow, in addition to other nutrients. So we are giving them carbon dioxide from the air.
Well, they look very healthy.
Yeah. And we plan to use only biological control on this crop. We won't use any pesticides, so we follow strict sanitation practices. Not everybody could come to the greenhouse if they have been to other areas before. That's one precaution we take. And then later on, we'll hang yellow sticky traps. Many flying insects get attracted to them. So in this way, we're able to monitor it. This is the purpose of our research, to have minimal pesticide use in our crops.
What would make greenhouse owners interested in the way that this grows?
This variety is a vertical growing habit, like a cucumber. Up till now, most of the varieties were more horizontal, like you grow outside field-grown squash. And they were not suited for greenhouse use, because in a greenhouse, we could use the space which is more vertical, which is going upward. So this plant would like to grow up to 8-9 feet high and then see how does it perform.
The last building on our tour is truly a glass house. Inside, a few rows of deep, earth-filled boxes house tiny plants that are awakening from a winter sleep.
Here we are growing mostly Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea pallida and purpurea. These are the one where we like to use the roots, so these are much deeper growing channels. Primarily, we use peat moss as a growing media, because this was a part of a research to study organic fertilizer. So this peat media has been mixed with the organic fertilizer, which is called 6-2-4, and next crop is going to be on the same growing channels. What you see here is already last year plants which are regenerating themselves. One other channel is where we are studying a plant called burdock, in which the roots are also used. That's a biennial plant, mean that after 2 years start flowering. We harvested good roots last year with some good quality coming on them. And what you see on the right-hand side is a burdock, the second year one, which is being regenerated right now.
What would you use the Echinacea and burdock for? What is their benefit from a medicinal point of view?
Echinacea, all the three species I'm talking about, they're primarily, they are classified as immune system boosters. So many people use it for flu and colds. And right now a study is going on at the University of Alberta to document which is the chemical ingredient which has helped with the immune system. So that's going to be a nice study, and it will help if the results are positive. I'm sure it's going to be positive. Then I'm sure their demand will increase, and that's going to be very beneficial for us. Burdock is a plant in which the roots are used for more like for cancer treatment. So I have seen some research report on its efficiency, but we are mostly studying it from a yield viewpoint, that how much we could get per square meter and what type of insects and what type of disease pressure is on those plants.
What are you finding out so far?
We could grow them. The main purpose was that the organic fertilizer gave us higher level of chemical ingredient. This was very exciting. The chemical ingredient in Echinacea, it's called echinacosides. That's a group of different chemicals called alkyl butamides. We found that with organic fertilizer, the level was higher than the inorganic fertilizer we use. So that was quite exciting. So we want to repeat that study for the second year. With burdock, we found that it's a very big leaf and very susceptible to an insect called spider mites. So we are trying to control it with more biological control. The big advantage with burdock is the roots which we are interested in. So even if few insects come and eat the leaves, it's not a big issue for us.
Gee, I had burdock in my garden and I took Roundup to it. I had no idea it was so beneficial.
Yeah, burdock roots, you could make a nice tea out of them, and it's very nice as a general purpose cleanser as well for the body. So this whole medicinal plant area is very intriguing and exciting. We still have to work on rules and regulation so that what the consumer gets is a good product. Our main purpose is mostly the research on the agronomic aspect of the plant.
We've gone through all of these different greenhouses and seen various different aspects of the type of research you're doing. If you step back for a moment and think about it, what's the excitement for you?
I think the main thing is that can we generate enough information so that the Alberta farmers could benefit, Alberta consumers could benefit, and can we contribute more towards the economy? Our main purpose is to give the information to the growers, how could they diversify their crops, what type of problems they will face, what type of yield they're going to get, and it's getting very exciting.
Thank you very much.
It's appreciated.
That was Dr. Mohyeddin Mirza, a greenhouse crop specialist with Alberta Agriculture, Food, and Rural Development. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And we were touring the research facility at the Crop Diversification Center in North Edmonton. Stepping into the lab on the third floor of the Medical Sciences Building at the University of Alberta, I'm struck by the newness of my surroundings. The white walls are freshly painted, and bright red accents the newly installed benches and cabinets. Still to come is the bank of computers and other specialized equipment that are the heart of Project CyberCell. It's here that I meet the director of the Institute for Biomolecular Design, Dr. Michael Ellison. He will lead a team of scientists who will meticulously measure and input data on the protein molecules of the lowly E. coli bacteria. Their goal over the next decade is to create virtual life.
Well, this piece of complex-looking equipment is what is called a mass spectrometer. And this instrument is very quickly becoming the instrument of what we now call the new science. And this instrument costs about $500,000, and we expect to have about 10 of these instruments lined up against this wall in the next few months. And what this instrument does is it can precisely measure the molecular weight of biomolecules. And by measuring very precisely down to a single hydrogen atom resolution, the molecular weight of proteins and DNA and so on and so forth, then you fingerprint them. And so we can very, very rapidly identify the cellular complement of the systems that we're interested in.
What are you going to be looking at with Project CyberCell?
Project CyberCell is an effort to construct, in essence, life on a computer. We're going to start with a very, very simple bacterium called E. coli. And the reason why we've selected E. coli is it's the organism for which the most is known in molecular terms. And it's the simplest organism in molecular terms. And so by studying E. coli as a model, we can work out all of the more complicated computer algorithms to be able to deal with small molecule uptake, the use of nutrients by this organism, the use of energy, molecular processes such as the replication of DNA, protein production, and so on and so forth. And so essentially what we're doing is we're constructing very, very large databases that relate the expression of protein to the expression of the gene and to the catalysis and the products that a given enzyme or protein will produce. And if we have all of this information and it's quantitated, then this represents the foundation for starting to think about it in quantitative terms.
With the E. coli, you say that that's a relatively simple organism to start with, but my understanding is that it has at least 4,000 proteins. That sounds awfully complicated to me.
Well, you're quite informed. Yes, there are 4,000 proteins in this organism, but if you take a mammalian cell, a human cell, there are probably upwards of 50,000 proteins. So from our perspective, this is where we would want to start.
Why proteins?
people over the past few years have paid an enormous amount of attention to DNA. And of course, you know from the Human Genome Project, which was announced recently, that it really is a tour de force. But DNA, the information contained in DNA, although it defines you and I and distinguishes us from the rest of the animal world, really is an inventory of information, which is not really understood in terms of how that information manifests itself as a cell. Now, what DNA does is that DNA encodes the information which makes proteins. And so in E. coli, as you pointed out, there are 4,000 different kinds of proteins. Well, these proteins are really the major operators in the cell. These proteins catalyze very, very specific reactions. Every component of the cell that exists because of the work that proteins do. And so each protein is dedicated to a specific task.
Now, what would you be doing with all of this stuff? What's the point of it?
The concept of the virtual cell or the cyber cell is really, when you think about it, the culmination of modern biology. It means that we believe as scientists that life can be understood in molecular terms, and molecules follow fundamental rules, and we know what those rules are. What we're really dealing with, however, is a very, very complex molecular puzzle. And so we'll rely heavily on computers to put this puzzle together. And when we've done that, and we can, let's say, accurately predict the behavior of a cell in a virtual environment such that it can evolve, grow, divide, adapt to its environment, and we know that this bears a good deal of relationship to reality, then I think at that point we can say that we understand life well enough. I think one of the really fascinating things about the cyber cell is not the numerous applications it'll have to biotechnology, but it's the idea that you can actually observe virtual evolution. So we know that evolution is a process whereby an organism gradually adapts to its environment through the process of mutation. So we can imagine setting up conditions and allowing a cell to actually evolve on a computer very, very rapidly, well beyond in the twinkling of an eye by comparison to the billions of years it's taken E. coli to adapt its normal form. And that's a really fascinating prospect, to be able to see the course of evolution computationally.
Now, once you get all of these things mapped out on the computer and you can start manipulating them, what are you trying to achieve with the manipulation?
What we ultimately intend to do with this is, the sky is the limit. I mean, it's virtually limitless, the sorts of things that we could plan on using it for. For instance, drug development is a very random process involving the random testing of hundreds of thousands of compounds. So to develop a given drug against a given disease is a process that will take a pharmaceutical company 10 to 20 years. So with the cyber cell, since we understand its workings so intimately, we can use this virtual cell sitting simply at a laptop computer. We imagine, for instance, being able to treat this cell and screen drug compounds very, very rapidly for the effects. And so we might expect to be looking for two things. Obviously, we'll be looking for drugs that have the desired effect on the cell type that we're interested in, but we'll also be looking for drugs that don't have any adverse effects on the cell type.
Now, how can you tell that just by looking at a computer screen? What are the characteristics that would let you know that this is going to work or it's not going to work?
Well, that's a really good question, because you can imagine that what it's going to take to develop the cyber cell is going to be a series of very, very, very complicated computer programs. And one of the problems that we're going to have to deal with is, how does a person visualize all of these cellular activities in some intuitive way that allows them to actually get a sense of what's happening when we perturb the environment of the cell? So one might imagine, for instance, that we could start off at the first level, where we actually see a picture of the cell. And if we treat it, let's say, with a compound that we're interested in testing, we may expect to see, for instance, that the growth rate of the cell starts to drop. That's something that could may be displayed graphically on the side of the computer. We may find that its speed in doubling actually increases. We may find that the outer compartment that surrounds the cell starts to look funny. So these may be signs that we can use in the same way that we would use a microscope, in the same way that we would actually do wet experiments to test the effects of a compound on a living organism. The next level is we can imagine that this program is hierarchical. So we would move down the next level of resolution and start looking inside the cell. Maybe it's certain molecular substructures within the cell, the chromosome, the inner cell membrane, so on and so forth. But ultimately, what we want to be able to do is get down to the molecular level. What specific protein is being affected by this particular drug? It's there in the computer. What we have to do is find an intuitive way of bringing the information out quickly.
Do you have anything that you could show me on the computer to give me an example?
Well, we're standing in front of a mass spectrometer, and as I said, the mass spectrometer is really used for precisely measuring the molecular weights of biomolecules, and it's a remarkably sensitive instrument. This may not mean anything to many people, but it's capable of detecting proteins down to the level of the femtomole, which is 10 to the minus 15th moles of protein. So it's a remarkably sensitive instrument. And the way this instrument works is you can see that there's a TV screen right here, and I have a little joystick. And the sample is within this large box that looks a bit like a beer refrigerator. And I can actually move the joystick around, which points a laser at the protein, which is spotted on a metal grid. The laser hits the metal grid, and it evaporates the protein into a vacuum, and it accelerates the protein along a tube, the speed of acceleration is correlated with its molecular weight. And it's such a sensitive instrument, as I said, that it is capable of distinguishing a protein that has a molecular weight, let's say, of 200,000 Daltons from a protein that is 200,000 and 1 Daltons, a remarkably sensitive piece of equipment. And so what you see on the computer screen is simply the trace of biomolecules that has been detected in this particular sample. This one may correspond to glucose. This may correspond to a modified form of glucose. And we can really run the gamut from very, very small proteins to very, very large proteins with the sorts of mass spectroscopy that we're putting into this facility.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Dr. Michael Ellison is a professor of biochemistry at the University of Alberta, and he is the director of the Institute for Biomolecular Design, the group undertaking Project CyberCell. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.